hate it, you know? All of it. Not just what's happening to Allie, but also how Carol is. She's so suspicious and strained and ready to lash out. She has patrols circling her cabin because one night she thought she saw shadows moving in the trees. Emily Waterman came out of the cafeteria laughing about something, and Carol decided she must have been laughing at her and gave her a stone. Emily cried and cried. She's just a kid. He swung one foot. The laces of his boot were undone, and they swooped back and forth and clicked against the underside of the bed frame. After a moment, he asked, "Can I tell you something kind of personal, ma'am?" "Of course. A lot of people don't know I tried to kill myself once, right after my sisters burned to death. I was hiding in what was left of my house, which was half burnt down. My parents were gone. My sisters were these girl-shaped mounds of ash in the wreckage of the living room. I just wanted it all to go away. I didn't want to smell smoke anymore. I didn't want to be lonely. I had a little Honda scooter I used to deliver pizzas on. I started it up in the garage and waited for the exhaust to kill me. First I got a headache, then I threw up. Eventually I passed out. I was unconscious for about 40 minutes before the scooter ran out of gas, and then I woke up. I don't think the garage was very airtight. A few days after that, I went wandering. I had an idea maybe I'd find my way to the ocean and walk in to clean the stink off me. Harper remembered her own desolate morning walk to the ocean, not so long after she first came to camp. She wondered if Michael had gone to the water for the same reason as her, seeking a final cold plunge into quiet darkness, and no more worry, no more loneliness. Instead, I heard some girls singing. They were singing really nice, in sweet, clear voices. I was so out of it, I thought maybe it was my sisters calling to me. I found my way out of the trees and into Monument Park and saw it wasn't my sisters at all. It was Allie and Carol and Sarah Story and the firemen and a few others. They were singing a real old song, that one where the guy says he doesn't know much about history. Sam Cooke, I think. They were singing and they were all lit up, soft and blue and peaceful. They looked at me like they had been waiting all day for me to get there. I sat down to watch and listen, and at some point Carol sat beside me with a wet towel and began wiping the grime off my face. She said, "Oh, look, there's a boy under there." And I started crying. She just laughed at me and said, "That's another way to get the dirt off." I had been walking barefoot, and she got down and wiped the blood and the dirt off my feet. It would kill me to do anything to hurt her. I thought I'd never be loved like my mom and my sisters loved me, and then I found my way here. He paused, fidgeting, and then sighed, and when he spoke again, it was in a lower voice. "But that stuff Carol said about taking your baby away from you, I don't know why she'd even think something like that. We can't do that. And then there's the way she treats Allie. Seems like Allie has a stone in her mouth all day, every day. And she won't ever spit it out, because that would be like admitting defeat. Allie would rather starve first. You know how she is. And then sometimes after chapel, after we've been singing our hardest, I come back to myself, and my head is ringing like after I tried to kill myself in the garage. Sometimes I think the way we give ourselves over to the bright now, those are also like little suicides." He sniffled, and Harper realized he was close to tears. "It used to be better. It used to be really good here. Anyway, like Allie said in her letter, you aren't all alone. You've got us, Allie and me. Thank you, Michael. Is there anything I can do for you?" "Yes, there is. But if it's too much, you must say no. Don't feel you have to do anything that would put you at more risk than is safe." "Uh-oh," he said. "I was thinking maybe you'd want me to sneak you some creamers for your coffee. I guess you're thinking bigger." "Is there any way I can get out of here for an hour to see the firemen? And if I did, could you keep a close eye on Father's Story while I'm gone?" He blanched. "I'm sorry. I shouldn't have asked." "No," he said. "It's okay. I could cover for you if Mr. Patchett showed up, I guess. I could pull the curtain across your bed, put some pillows under your sheets, and tell him you're napping. Just, if I sneak you out, if I get you together with him, do you promise you'll come back? You aren't going to jump in a car with the fireman and take off tonight, are you? Of all the things he could have said or asked, she had not seen that one coming. Oh, Michael, of course I wouldn't. I wouldn't abandon Father Story in his condition. Good, because you can't leave camp, he said and sat forward and gripped her wrist. Not without taking Allie and me. 12. Harper descended the hill through a bitter cold that stung her nostrils and hurt her lungs. Her breath smoked, as if she were going full dragon, burning from the inside out. It was coldest on the shale, alongside the water, numbing the exposed parts of her face. A thread of smoke rose from the tin chimney on the fireman's shed, the only sign of life in the entire ice-locked world. She hated walking out on the dock, felt exposed, half expected someone to shout. But no one saw her, and the dock itself was hidden from the church steeple by a band of tall evergreens. She lowered herself into the rowboat and cast off the line. Once she was on the water, she might be visible. The eye in the steeple sees all the people. But it was moonless and starless, and she thought in the deep dark she might go unobserved. This time she was able to walk to the shed without losing her boots in the mud. The muck was frozen to the hardness of tile. Harper knocked on the door frame. When no one replied, she knocked again. From within she smelled wood smoke and sickness. "It's unlocked," the fireman said. She eased into the little room, into stifling heat and golden light from the open furnace. He was in bed, with a sheet snarled around his waist and legs, arm in his filthy sling. The room had an odor of phlegm, and his breathing was strenuous. She dragged a chair to the side of his bed and sat down. Then she leaned forward and put the side of her face to his bare chest. His skin blazed and smelled of sandalwood and sweat. The dragon scale decorated his breast in patterns that brought to mind Persian carpets. "Breathe normally," she said. "I didn't bring a stethoscope." "I was getting better." "Shut up. I'm listening." His inhalations crackled faintly, like someone rolling up plastic wrap. "Shit," she said. "You've developed an atelectasis. I don't have a thermometer, but I can tell you're feverish." Shit. "I don't understand." "I think Atelectasis was an early album by Genesis. One of the ones they recorded before Phil Collins took over singing and they turned to middlebrow MTV crap." "It's a smarty-pants word for a certain kind of pneumonia. You see this as a complication with fractured ribs, but I wouldn't expect it in a man your age. Have you been smoking?" "No. You know I don't have cigarettes." "Have you had any fresh air?" "A great deal." She narrowed her eyes at him. "How long is a great deal?" 18 hours, give or take a couple." "Why were you outside for 18 hours? "I didn't mean to be. I passed out. I always pass out when I send a phoenix somewhere." He gave her an apologetic smile. "I was too weak, I think. Not ready to create one. It took too much out of me. Although it's a good thing I sent one. As if their machine gun wasn't bad enough, that plow your ex is driving around is as bad as a panzer." "Wait a minute. Go back. How do you know my ex showed up at Verdun Avenue? Who told you?" "No one told me. I was there with you." "What do you mean you were there with me?" He sighed, winced, pressed his good hand to his bad side. "You hid behind Ben's police cruiser when the shooting started. Nelson was the first one to die. He was torn apart in the street. Then the town truck hit the ambulance, and Mindy Skilling was mashed beneath it. After, you tore out of there like one of your American NASCAR blokes. I recall everything right up to the moment your ex smashed the van and nearly crushed me flat. Nearly crushed the Phoenix flat, I mean." Harper couldn't wrap her head around it. Up until now, she had assumed the Phoenix was a glorious pyrotechnic display that could somehow be operated from a distance, rather like a remote-control airplane. A puppet of flame, with John Rookwood tugging the strings from here on his island. Yet he could recount the confrontation with Jacob and the Marlborough man as if he had fought it out with them in person, a concept Harper found perplexing and also irritating, because John so clearly loved being impressive and mysterious. That's impossible. You can't have seen all that.
Oh, let's not get carried away. It's only improbable.
And besides, I didn't say I saw it. I didn't see it, but I remember it.
He saw her getting ready to interrupt and held a hand up, palm out, to forestall questions.
You know that the dragon scale, over time, saturates the human brain. It listens in to your thoughts and feelings and reacts to them. It's dendritic in nature, and it bonds with the mind.
Yes, that's why people catch fire when they're afraid or under stress. Panic releases cortisol. The dragon scale reacts to cortisol by assuming the host is no longer safe. It erupts into flame, producing lots of ash, enabling it to depart for better real estate.
He looked at her with admiration. Yes, that's the mechanism, exactly. Who have you been talking to?
Harold Cross, Harper said, pleased to surprise him for once. The fireman took this in, then lifted one corner of his mouth in a smile.
You found his notebook. I'd love to see it sometime.
Maybe after I'm done with it, she said. Cortisol kicks off spontaneous combustion, but oxytocin, the social networking hormone, puts the dragon scale at ease. Anytime you feel the pleasure of group approval, you increase the dragon scale's sense of security and make it less likely to burn you to death later.
That I understand. I can't understand how you could be here in your cabin, why also seeing things that were happening 2 miles away.
But I told you, I didn't see them. I remember them, and that's the difference.
The phoenix has a cloud of dragon scale burning at its core. That dragon scale contains a crude copy of my thoughts, my feelings, my responses. It's an outboard brain. Eventually it returned to me, came back to the nest, where it died out, having done its job. The ash fell on me like snow while I was unconscious on the beach, and in the hours that followed, I dreamt everything the bird did and saw. It all came back to me, fragmentary at first, but eventually the entire awful scene.
Harper weighed this notion in her mind. Ash that could think and flame that lived, and a spore that could swap impulses and memories with the human mind. It was, she thought, just exactly the sort of fantastical nonsense evolution was always going in for. Nature was a grand one for sleight of hand and magic tricks. When she spoke again, it concerned the dragon scale not at all.
You need a course of antibiotics.
As it happens, I have some.
I'll send Michael over with a bottle of azithromycin. He should be able to slip over during the changing of the watch at dawn. Come on, Mr. Rookwood, let's have a look at your arm.
I take it you won't be available to bring my medicine yourself.
She declined to meet his gaze. Instead, she gently loosened the sling and unbent his elbow. He grimaced, but she thought it was more from the anticipation of pain than any actual suffering.
Things are going sour here, John. I'm confined to the infirmary, on house arrest, and forbidden to leave Father Story's side. I'm only here tonight because Michael drew watch, and Mike isn't playing by Carol's rules anymore. Neither is Allie, who was on permanent house arrest in the girls' dorm.
Michael was afraid if he let me go see you, I might not come back. He doesn't want me driving off without him.
She considered for a moment. It's only a matter of time before a couple dozen defectors try to make a run for it. Fill some cars with supplies and light out. Renee has already talked about leaving with Don and the prisoners and a few others.
Where would you go?
Oh, I don't know that I'd head out with them, whatever Michael thinks. While there's still a chance for Father Story, it wouldn't be right to abandon him.
The fireman did a strange thing then. He glanced past her at the furnace, then leaned in and spoke in a soft voice, as if he didn't want to be overheard.
I admire a good bit of foolishness more than anyone, Harper, but in this case it won't do. Your first obligation is to yourself and that baby, not to Tom Story.
He had the biggest heart of any man I ever knew, and I'm sure he wouldn't want you to stay for him.
He's been under for how long? 6 weeks? 7? After a crushing blow to the head at the age of 70? He's gone. He's not coming back.
Men have recovered from worse, she said. Although as she spoke, Harper found herself wondering if she even still knew the difference between a diagnosis and a denial.
Besides,
John, I'm close. 9 weeks? 8? I need somewhere to have this baby. The infirmary is a good place. I don't know if I can find better. Don could deliver the child. He's reeled in plenty of fish. I'm sure he can manage one more. Right now, so close to my due date, I wouldn't leave camp unless there was no other choice. She did not mention that if Father Story died, she really would have no other choice. She would run with the baby or be sent into exile without it. But she did not want to distress John by telling him about Carol's threats. Not now. John was sick. He was beat up and feverish, and his lungs were full of filthy damp. Her job was to give sympathy and care, not elicit it. She got up, went through some drawers beneath what had once been a work table, and came back with some scissors. Harper snipped the filthy tape away from his wrist. It was still swollen and grotesquely discolored, but it was only a little stiff when she asked him to rotate it, and she decided it didn't need to be rebound. I think we can be done with the sling as well, but keep the brace on your elbow until you can bend the arm without sharp pain, and try to rest it. Until you've had a little more time to heal, you better limit yourself to intellectual masturbation only. We don't want to put any undue strain on this wrist. For once, he had nothing to say. She sat back and said, You know, Michael won't leave camp without Allie, and I'm sure Allie won't run without Nick. It scares the shit out of me to imagine them ditching camp and taking their chances out in the wild. What about you? They'd be safe if they went with you. You could look after them, Allie and Nick. His gaze shifted briefly to the furnace behind her, then dropped. And do you really think I'm in any condition to go anywhere? Maybe not now, but we'll make you better. I'll make you better. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. There isn't even a plan yet, just a lot of loose talk. Harper cast a slow and uneasy glance at the open furnace herself. She saw no one looking back at her from the flames, not a mystery woman and not Sirius Black. She thought of how John had glanced at the fire before leaning close to speak in a soft voice, as if he did not want to be overheard. Something else occurred to her, almost randomly, something he had said about the phoenix. It's an outboard brain. The thought raised a chill on the nape of her neck. No, she said, but we better get working on one. I think we should try to meet here, all of us, even the prisoners, if it can be managed. We don't just need to work out how we're going to leave, but also where we're going to go and how we intend to survive. She steeled herself and added gently, You say Father Story wouldn't want me to risk my life or the baby's life by staying. I say Sarah wouldn't want you to risk your life by staying. Oh, I don't know, he said. It wouldn't be so bad to be buried here. Why not? In some ways, I feel like this is where my real life started. Here in Camp Wyndham, where I met Sarah, and where we all returned after we came down with Dragon Scale. There would be a certain narrative elegance in my life ending here as well. Fuck narrative elegance. How did you all wind up deciding to hide out here? Nowhere else to go? That simple, really. You can do better than that, Harper said. If you insist, he told her. 13. We were all marked. The first lines appeared on Nick's arm and back. 3 days later, we looked like we had all gone to the same tattoo parlor in hell. Except for Sarah. In the space of 72 hours, Sarah had to face the idea of losing her son, her daughter, her sister, her father, and her boyfriend. You'd expect a person to quit functioning. But she didn't quit. Her children still needed her. And as long as they could feel and think and be comforted, she was set on being whatever they wanted her to be. Besides, for a couple of weeks she assumed she had the infection too, and just wasn't symptomatic. I think when she finally realized she didn't have it, she was more upset and shocked than she would have been if she did. How could every one of us have it except her? She got mad at me a couple of times, as if it were my fault she wasn't crawling with Dragon Scale. Why all of you and not me? That's what she kept asking. She was in the pool, Harper murmured. Figured it out, did you? Yes. The poisoned ash fell from the sky, and we all got it on us, but Sarah had gone swimming. The chlorine killed the spore. or at least created a barrier against it. In any random slaughter, the difference between living and dying rarely has anything to do with willpower or wisdom or pluck. It's just a matter of where you're standing. 2 inches to the right and the bus hits you. If your office is on the 92nd floor instead of the 90th, you don't make it out in time. Sarah put off grief. She put off a nervous collapse. I don't know how she bore up, but she did. The only time I saw her nearly hysterical was when her father said we should all book ourselves into the federal quarantine in Concord. The thought of her children being taken from her was like being prodded with hot sticks. We had to back off. I think we were all afraid of what she might do to herself if we created a situation where Allie or Nick might be yanked from her life and never seen again. For a few days, Allie stayed curled up in a ball, just crying. Then one morning, she came out of the bathroom with her head shaved and announced she was all done being sad. That night, her mother and Allie did shrooms together. The next night, Sarah and Allie snuck out and stole a car. They were deranged, but happy. They looted a costume store. Sarah came home as Hillary Clinton. Allie took a Captain America mask because she liked the big A on it. They thoughtfully brought a Tony the Tiger mask for Nick. I said I always wanted to be a fireman, and next time I hope they'd think of me. 2 nights later, they stole an antique fire truck from the parking lot of a museum full of classic cars, and all the fireman gear that was inside it. They had to park it in the boathouse at Camp Wyndham, just to have a place to stick it. Allie was determined to raise some hell before she died, and Sarah felt it was important for a mother to support her daughter's goals in life. I didn't think Carol would last long. I remember that. She dropped 10 pounds she didn't have to lose. She stopped sleeping. She'd watch TV, half-naked, for 12 hours straight, as insensible as someone who has had a lobotomy. She smelled like a lit match and was always seeping smoke. The only thing that could bring her out of her miasma was her father, who made sure she ate and slept and otherwise tended to her needs. Then one morning I heard banging doors and screaming in the street. It was early and I was the only one up. I crept down the walk and looked out over the hedge. They had a lorry pulled up in front of a house down the street, a police van that had been pressed into service by quarantine patrol. Some SWAT types in gas masks were wrestling a woman into it. They had a doctor with them, in a mask and gloves, carrying a clipboard, and telling her this was for the protection of her own children, telling her they would contact an appropriate relative to come and collect the kids. A boy of about 4 was sobbing his eyes out, trying to follow them. Another member of the quarantine patrol kept taking him by the shoulder and turning him around. Somewhere inside the house I could hear a baby shrieking. Just before they shoved the woman into the truck, she turned her head, and I saw her face. It was the same lady who had been weeping on the curb the day the drugstore went up in flames. That afternoon, we had a family conference around the dining room table, and I filled them in on what I had seen. Allie said we needed a plan, in case they came back and knocked on our door. Tom said if such a thing happened, the best thing we could do was not be there to answer it. He said he had spent every summer for the last 40 years at Camp Wyndham, and saw no reason to change his plans now, and never mind summer camp had been cancelled. He said he had been over to camp with Carol once already, and there were enough dry goods on hand to feed an army for a decade. He was only off by 9 years. He settled into the house that had always been his, supposedly with Carol to look after him, although it was really the other way around. Sarah and I claimed a cabin close to the boathouse because Nick liked to play fireman on our stolen fire truck. Would it sound strange to say those were lovely days? We had fresh eggs then, waffles and coffee. We had swims at dawn and campfires at dusk. Sarah dusted off the organ in the church and played Billy Joel and Paul McCartney. She tried to get a sister to play with her, but Carol stayed in the house of the Black Star, her scales smoking and fuming, waiting to die. One morning Sarah went into Portsmouth to get news and groceries. She could shop for us. She wasn't sick. She came back with the neighbor's girls. 2 days later, Norma Held showed up on her own. She had worked in the cafeteria in summers past and thought it would be safer to look for food here than in a supermarket. That was the beginning of Tom's people. A few days after Norma showed up in camp, Carol came flying out of the house of the Black Star, looking wild, almost incoherent with terror, found Sarah, and said it was happening. She said to come quick. She said Tom and Nick were lighting up, that both of them were about to burst into flame. We ran so hard and fast we left Carol behind. We ran sick and scared. You can't imagine what it's like to run so hard towards something you don't want to see. Like running toward your own firing squad. I was sure we'd find both of them withered and blackened, the house afire. Sarah burst through the front door and then stopped so suddenly I ran into her and knocked her down. Allie was right behind me and tripped over the both of us. We were all tangled together on the floor when I saw them. The dishwasher in that house has to be older than you, Harper. It had seen almost 3 decades of service and thumped and shook when it was turned on. The beat, if you can imagine it, is very like that old song, Woolly Bully. You know that one? Tom sat with his back to the machine and Nick in his lap and that woolly bully thump going through the both of them. Tom had his fingers laced through Nick's and he was singing and the both of them were shining. Tom had his sleeves rolled back to show the scale on his forearms and it was as brilliant as swirls of glow-in-the-dark paint. It didn't bother him at all, watching us crash in through the doors like the Keystone Cops. He gave us a laughing sort of look and went right on singing. Sarah said, "Oh, Dad, oh, God, what's happening to you?" And he said, "I'm not sure, but I think the Dragon Scale likes Sam the Sham. Come and sing with us and see if you don't like the way it makes you feel." By the time Carol came through the door, we were all sitting together in a circle by the thumping dishwasher, singing garage rock and lit up like a carnival. As soon as the Dragon Scale started to warm up and glow, you knew you were all right, that you weren't going to burn. Well, you know what it's like in the bright. We sang until the dishwasher finished its cycle. And as soon as the machine quit thumping, our Dragon Scale began to cool and go dim. We were all so high. I couldn't remember which of Tom's daughters I was dating, so I kissed both of them. Sarah had a laugh at that. Allie kept counting her toes, because she couldn't remember how many she had. I guess you'd have to say we were good and baked. Baked! Ah, isn't that clever? Isn't it? No. Ah, well. We gathered the others in the chapel that evening. Sarah sat at the organ and Carol tuned her ukulele and they played Bridge Over Troubled Water and Let It Be, and we lit up like sparks blowing from a bonfire. Their voices were so smoky and sweet. I have never been so drunk or so happy. I could feel myself letting go of my identity. The way you might put down a heavy suitcase you no longer need carry. It was, I imagine, how bees feel. Not like an individual at all, but like one humming note in a whole world of perfect, useful music. After we were all sung out, Tom spoke to us. That seemed natural. He told us things we knew but needed to hear. He told us we were lucky for every minute we had together, and I knew it was true. He told us it was a blessing to be able to feel each other's love and happiness so intensely, right on our skin, and I said amen, and so did all the rest of us. He told us that in the darkest moments of history, kindness was the only light you had to find your way to safety, and I know I cried to hear him say it. I feel a little like crying now, just remembering it. It's easy to dismiss religion as bloody, cruel, and tribal. I've done it myself. But it isn't religion that's wired that way. It's man himself. At bottom, every faith is a form of instruction in common decency. Different textbooks in the same class. Don't they all teach you that to do for others feels better than to do for yourself? That someone else's happiness need not mean less happiness for you? Only Sarah did not shine, because only Sarah did not have the Dragon Scale. But she knew as well as the rest of us that we had solved something. That we had found a working cure. We didn't need a spoonful of sugar to make the medicine go down. The sugar was the medicine. Sarah sang with us and watched us turn on and kept her own counsel. I had been with her long enough by then that I should have seen what was coming, what she would do. But I didn't see what was coming because I was drunk most of the time. Not drunk on booze, you understand. Drunk on that rush of light and pleasure that came over me when we all sang together. Allie began to go out at night in her Captain America mask to spy on friends kids she knew from school. If she saw they were sick with the scale, she'd recruit them and their families, tell them there was a way to stay alive, that the infection didn't have to be a death sentence. We had a dozen new people coming in every week. Sarah sent me along with Allie to make sure she got back to camp in one piece. I took to dressing as a fireman, because I discovered that in a world full of things burning up, no one looks at a fireman twice. I couldn't even remember my own name for most of June. I was so drunk on the bright. I was just the fireman. He coughed weakly. A fragrant puff of smoke blew from his mouth, turned into the ghost of toy-sized fire truck, and dissolved.
Show off, Harper said. What happened next?
Sarah died, he said, and bent forward and surprised Harper by kissing her nose. The end. Book 7. No Straight Arrow. March 1. From the Diary of Harold Cross. August 28th. Martha Quinn is real. Has a website. Martha Quinn in Maine. They process you in Machias, clean you up, give you fresh clothes and a square meal, and take you over on a lobster boat. They've got what's left of the CDC there working on a cure. I'm going, tomorrow or the day after. If I stay here, sooner or later I'll burn to death. The others are getting the benefit of social connection, but I'm not. And without regular doses of oxytocin, my biochemical fuse is still hissing. I won't be asking anyone's permission. I know I won't get it. Carol has me under pretty tight watch. The only thing I've got going for me is J.R. He's arranged to slip me out of here so I can get to the cabin tonight and send my last emails. Not sure how I'll make it so far north, what with all of southern Maine on fire, but J.R. says maybe a boat. I can't wait to say goodbye to this shithole forever.
2. Her first thought was, it can't be that easy. She turned the page, hoping for more, but that was it. After that, the notebook was blank. Rain fell. It hammered on the tin roof in a continuous rattle and crash. The rain had been falling 10 hours straight. Sometimes trees fell, too. Harper had woken to the sound of one going over somewhere close by, with a great creak and a floor-shaking smash. The wind struck the infirmary again and again, one battering rush after another. It was like the end of the world out there. But then every day was like the end of the world now, come rain or shine. Harper had not imagined there was anything left in the diary to learn, let alone shock her. Martha Quinn was real. The island was a real place. Nick was watching her carefully. No surprise there. Harper had long since quit trying to keep the notebook secret from him. It was, in the narrow confines of the ward, impossible anyway. She met his intense, unwavering, curious gaze. He did not ask if she had read something important. He knew. It was a lookout named Chuck Cargill in the waiting room that night. He had walked in on Harper 2 hours ago, when she had her sweater off and was rubbing lotion on the pink curve of her stupendous belly. She had a bra on, but Cargill was nevertheless so alarmed to find her in a state of undress. He had dropped the breakfast tray he was carrying on the counter with a clatter, as if it had suddenly become too hot to handle. He reeled backward, stammering some sort of incoherent apology, and ducked back out through the curtain. Ever since, he had been careful to clear his throat, knock on the doorframe, and ask for permission to come in. Harper thought he might never be able to make eye contact with her again. She also thought if she wanted to get the phone down out of the ceiling, he probably wouldn't walk in on her while she was using it. No one else would either. Even Ben Patchett wasn't going to do spot inspections on a night like tonight. Harper turned the straight-backed chair around and climbed unsteadily onto it. She reached into the ceiling, found the cell phone, and climbed back down. Nick stared at her, at it, with wide, fascinated, wondering eyes. She gestured with her head. Come over here. They walked to the far end of the ward, putting as much distance between themselves and the curtain into the waiting area as they could. Harper and Nick sat down side by side on the edge of Father Story's cot, with their backs to the doorway into the next room. If Cargill did suddenly walk in, the phone would be concealed by their bodies, and she might have time to shut it down and stick it under the mattress. She squeezed the power button. The screen flashed gray, then a deep obsidian black. The battery life was a whopping 9%. Harper pulled up the browser and loaded Martha Quinn in Maine. 3. Music played, tinny and flat through the little iPhone speakers, barely audible over the rain, but no less lovely for all of that. It was a song Harper used to perform herself when she was 8 years old, using a wooden spoon as the microphone, sliding across the kitchen linoleum in her Miss Piggy slippers. Rick Ocasek sang that this one girl was just what he needed, over a melody that sproinged along like a slinky walking down a staircase. Photos loaded, but slowly. The first showed a vast, gradual slope of waist-high grass, yellowing in the autumn. The ocean was a sheet of battered steel in the background. Martha Quinn stood in the center of a long line of children, five on either side of her, her arms around the waists of the two closest. She was as bony as ever, and even at nearly 60, her face was impish and kind, her eyes narrowed in a way that suggested she had a good joke she wanted to tell. The wind blew her platinum hair back from her high brow. Her sleeves were rolled up to show the dragon scale on her forearms, a black and gold scrollwork that brought to mind ancient writings in kanji. As the song faded, a second photograph loaded. A doctor in a white lab coat, a pretty Asian woman with a clipboard in one hand, crouched to be at eye level with a scrumptious 9-year-old girl. The little girl clutched a stuffed raccoon doll to her chest, and her nose was wrinkled in a shriek of laughter. Her bare, chubby arms were lightly scribbled over with scale. They were in the white, clean, sterile hall of a hospital unit somewhere. There was a sign on the wall in the background, blurred, almost out of focus. It wasn't an important part of the image, and so Harper saw it without really noticing it, then narrowed her eyes and looked again. When she registered what it said, the intensity of her emotions drove all the air out of her. Just two words. Pediatrics, maternity. The third photo began to load as the song faded out. A voice began to speak, a voice Harper knew only from 1980s retrospectives on VH1 and MTV. The volume was already so low, Harper could barely hear Martha Quinn over the furious tinny drumming of rain on the ceiling. But out of caution, she turned it down still more and bent close to listen. "Woo! Hello! Was that just what you needed? It was just what I needed. Well, it was one of the things I needed. It's a pretty long list. I need to know that Michael Fassbender is still alive because, hello, that man was right in so many ways. He was setting ladies on fire way before the spore got loose, you know what I mean? I need new episodes of Doctor Who. But I'm not holding my breath because I bet everyone who made that show is dead or hiding. Is there still an England out there? I hope you didn't burn up, British Isles. Where would the world be without your epic contributions to culture? Duran Duran, Idris Elba, and Love Actually. Drop me an email, England. Let me know you are still hanging in there." The next image showed a large tent with some folding tables set up in it. A processing center. The tables were manned by the sort of broad-shouldered, blue-haired old ladies that worked high school cafeterias. Although they wore the bright yellow spacesuits that were standard for anyone who might come in contact with Ebola, anthrax, or dragon scale. One of the stout old ladies was offering a stack of blankets, pajamas, and forms to a kind of family. An old man with bushy gray eyebrows, a fatigued-looking woman of maybe 30, and two little boys with bright coppery hair. "I need peach pie. Bad. I am sorry to say there is no peach pie here on Free Wolf Island, but we do have our own apple orchard. And boy, I can't wait until it's apple-picking season and I can go out and get myself a basket of Granny Smiths, Cortland's, Honey Crisps, Honey Boo Boos, Honey Grahams, Graham Nortons, Ed Nortons, all that good stuff. No bad apples here. I wish there was a fruit named after me. I wonder what a Quinn would taste like. Probably it would taste like 1987.
The best thing about radio is you can imagine me just like I looked in 1987. Every man's fantasy. And by every man, I mean shy 13-year-olds who like to read comics and listen to The Cure. Anywho, I need more solar panels. I only have 4 lousy solar panels. It's okay. That's better than none. But as you know, I can only broadcast for 3 hours a day, and then our transponder transpires to expire. A heads up. You are probably not hearing me live, but on a recorded loop. We upload a new loop every day around 11 a.m., give or take 24 hours. Nick couldn't hear Martha Quinn, but he could see the images loading on the screen, and he bent forward, eyes as wide as one who has been mesmerized. What else do I need? I need you to get your butt up to Machias and come on over, because we've got cocoa and barrels of walnuts and a former TV weather anchor who makes amazing fresh bread in a wood-fired stove. Do you know what I'm talking about? I'm talking about Free Wolf Island, located 17 miles off the coast of Maine, a place where you can safely settle if you, yes, you, happen to be the lucky winner of a case of Dragon Scale. We've got a bed for you. And that's not all. We've got a federally operated medical facility where you can receive cutting-edge experimental treatments for your condition. As I speak to you, I myself, Martha Quinn, am lubed up in a cutting-edge experimental salve that smells and looks exactly like sheep shit. And guess what? I have not burned alive all day. I haven't even had a hot flash. My last hot flash was in 2009, and that was before the infection even got started. Now a photo of an island seen from off the coast. A ridge of green, a beach of blue stone, a scattering of New England-style cottages along a single dirt road. The sun was just coming up or just setting, and it cast a gold flare upon the dark water. No one is saying the word cure. Do not even whisper the word cure. There are 600 sick people on this island, and what they are mostly sick of, besides the Draco Tripto whatever, is getting their hopes up over the latest treatment. But I will say that our last death by fire was almost 12 weeks ago. That's right. 600 infected and just 1 dead in the last 3 months. A final image showed a smiling elderly pair with a child. The man was gangly, weathered, with high, almost patrician cheekbones, and a weary relief in his eyes. His wife was small, round, the corners of her eyes deeply grooved with laugh lines. The man had a 5-year-old boy up on one shoulder. They wore fall clothes, flannel shirts, jeans, knit hats. The woman had dragon scales scrawled all over the backs of her hands. The caption read, Sally Neal and George Wanamaker arrive at the Machias Processing Center and prepare to depart for Free Wolf Island. Do you have friends and family on the island? Click for a photo gallery of the... And here a counter showed the number 602. People to receive shelter and comfort in the Free Wolf Island Quarantine and Research Zone. When you get to Machias, and you will get here, you have to believe that. I got here, and so will you. You will be directed to a processing tent. They'll take care of you. They'll give you a pillow, a blanket, a pair of cute paper slippers, and a hot meal. They'll put you on a boat and send you right over to us, where you will be fed, clothed, and housed. All that, plus the opportunity to rub elbows with incredible celebrities like myself. And a guy who did the weather for a channel in Augusta, Maine. What are you waiting for? Pack your stuff and get your little butt here. Your bed is made. Time to sleep in it. I'm going to spin another song, and then I'll be back with a list of the latest safe routes from Canada. Nick pointed to the picture of the island, and then asked Harper, in sign, Is this a real place? You bet, she said in gestures. A good place for sick people. When do we go? Nick's hands asked. Soon, Harper said, unconsciously speaking aloud while saying it with a gesture at the same time. In the bed behind her, Father Story sighed heavily and in a voice of quiet, gentle encouragement said, Soon. 4. When Harper's pulse had settled down, she checked Father Story's, holding his thin wrist in her fingers and monitoring the thump of the blood in his arteries. His heartbeat was slight and not altogether steady,
but she thought it had a little more zip than the day before. When she stroked a fingernail up his bare foot, he curled his toes and made a soft snort of amusement. When she had tested him that way last week, she might as well have been tickling a loaf of bread. She couldn't ask Nick if he had heard Father Story speak, of course, the only time his deafness had ever frustrated her. She wanted desperately for someone, anyone, to have heard him. She considered sending for Carol. Perhaps Tom would respond to his daughter's voice. By some accounts, he had before. Even if he didn't stir again, Carol had a right to know her father had spoken today. But after turning the thought over, she rejected it. Carol would rejoice to hear her father was recovering, but the rejoicing could wait. Harper wanted to talk to him before anyone else did. She wanted to see what he remembered, if anything, about the night he had been clubbed in the head. And she wanted to warn him about what the strain of the last months had done to Carol, how the winter had left her ravaged and feverish and mistrustful. He needed to know about the slaughter on Verdun Avenue, and children marching around camp with rifles, and people forced to carry stones in their mouths to shut them up. No, in truth, Tom didn't need to know those things. Harper needed him to know those things. She wanted the old man back to make things right again. How she had missed him. She sat with him the rest of the night, his hand in hers, stroking his knuckles. She spoke to him sometimes. "You hibernated through the whole winter, just like a bear," Tom Story. "The icicles are dripping. The snow is almost all gone. Time to wake up and crawl out of your cave. Nick and Allie and Carol and John are waiting for you. I'm waiting, too." But he did not speak again, and at some point close to dawn, she dozed off with his hand in her lap. Nick woke her an hour later. The rising sun shot through the mist outside, turned it shades of lemon and meringue, sweet as pie. "He looked at me," Nick told her with his hands. "He looked at me and smiled. He even winked before he went back to sleep. He's coming back." Yes, Harper thought. Like Aslan, he was coming back, and he was bringing the spring with him. Just in time, she thought. He's coming back just in time, and everything is going to be okay. Later, she would remember thinking that and laugh. It was either that or cry. 5. Harper needed to clear her head, needed to do some quality thinking, so she walked out of the infirmary into the bitter chill. No one stopped her. They were all in the chapel together. Harper could hear them singing, could see their mystery lights flickering around the edges of the closed red doors. The funny thing was that they were all singing Chim Chim Cherie, which didn't seem like the kind of rag they'd go for in chapel. Almost everyone in the congregation had seen someone they loved devoured by fire, lived in fear of burning themselves. But now their voices rose together in hopeful praise of ashes and soot, voices that quivered with a kind of hysterical delight. She left them behind. The air was clean and sharp, and the walking was easy. Harper had left her big belly and the baby inside of it, back at the infirmary, needed a break from being pregnant. It felt good to be thin again. She let her thoughts wander, and in no time at all found she had reached the place where the dirt track from camp joined Little Harbor Road. That was farther than she had meant to go, farther than was necessarily safe. She glanced at the rusting, battered blue school bus, expecting to be yelled at by whoever was on watch. A gaunt, dark figure slumped behind the steering wheel. She guessed whoever it was had to be dozing. She was going to turn around and walk back when she saw the man in the road. There was a guy, right in the middle of Little Harbor Road, not 100 feet away, pulling himself arm over arm, like a soldier wriggling under barbed wire on a battlefield. Or no, really, he was pulling himself along like someone whose legs didn't work. If anyone came along in a hurry, he was going to get run over. Aside from that, it was awful, watching him struggle along across the icy tarmac. "Hey!" Harper called. "Hey, you!" She lifted the chain draped across the entrance to Camp Wyndham and started briskly toward him. It was important to get this done, deal with the man in the road, and back out of sight before a car turned up. She shouted at him once more.
He lifted his head, but the only streetlight was behind him, so his face remained in shadow. A round, fleshy, fat face, hair thinning on top. Harper hurried the last few steps to him and knelt down. "Do you need medical attention?" she asked. "Can you stand up? I'm a nurse. If you think you can stand up, give me your hand, and I'll walk you to my infirmary." Nelson Heinrich lifted his head and gave her a sunny smile. His teeth were red with blood, and someone had removed his nose, leaving a pair of red slots in the ragged flesh. "Oh, that's all right, Harper. I've made it this far. I can lead them the rest of the way without your help." Harper recoiled, fell back into the road, sitting down hard. "Nelson, oh God, Nelson, what happened to you?"
"What do you think?" Nelson said. "Your husband happened to me, and now he's going to happen to you."
The headlights came on down the street, flashing over both of them. The freightliner awoke with a boom of combustion and a grinding of gears. Nelson said, "Go on, Harper. Go back." He winked. "I'll see you soon." She held her hands up over her face to shield her eyes from the light, and when she lowered them, she was awake, sitting up on her elbows in bed in the infirmary and having another contraction. "These are dreams about the baby coming," Harper said to herself in a low voice. "Not about Nelson Heinrich leading a cremation crew to camp. Nelson Heinrich is dead. He was torn apart by machine gun fire. You saw him dead in the road. You saw him." It was funny how the more she said it to herself, the less she believed it. 6. It was 5 days before Father Story spoke again. "Michael," the old man muttered, in a muddy tone of bemusement and curiosity, and a moment later Mike Lindquist pushed the curtain back and ducked into the ward. "Did you call for me, ma'am?" he asked Harper. The sound of Father Story's voice jackknifed Harper's pulse, made her blood strum with surprise. She opened her mouth to tell Michael that it had been the old man, then thought better of it. Michael would carry the news to Allie, and who knew where that would lead. "I did," Harper said. "I need your help. I need you to carry a note to Allie." "That's no trouble," he said. "I'm afraid I require a bit more than that. I want to get together with the firemen again, and I want Allie to go with me. Allie and Renee and Don Lewiston. You should be there, too, if it can be managed. And, if at all possible, Gil Klein and the Maz. Is there a way, any way, such a thing could be done?" Michael paled. He rested one cheek of his ass against the edge of the counter and lowered his head and plucked at the copper wires of his little goatee. Finally, he looked up. "What's this meeting about?" "The possibility of leaving. The possibility of staying. It's past time for some of us to make plans about our future. Father Story is stable for the moment, but if his condition changes suddenly, we'll want to be ready. For the worst? For whatever." Michael said, "If Carol finds you all out on the island together, making secret plans with the firemen, she'll lock every one of you up, or worse. We could face worse even if we do nothing." Michael swiped one hand across his freckled forehead and bowed his head in thought again. At last he nodded, uneasily. "I know how to do it. It isn't exactly like breaking them out of San Quentin. Renee visits the prisoners for lunch every day. That's when they meet for their little book club. That's the only time those boys ever come out of the meat locker. Renee tidied up a far corner of the basement, put down carpet and some easy chairs, so they'd have a nice place to read and talk. While they're meeting, whoever is on guard steps into the meat locker to clean up, empty the bucket they pee in during the day, gather up the dirty clothes, that sort of thing. So maybe while he's in there, the Maz comes back, says, 'Oops, I forgot my book,' and then on his way out closes the meat locker door. The guard is stuck in there for the whole hour. He can kick and shout all he wants. That meat locker is pretty soundproof with the door clapped shut. They'll never hear him during a noisy lunch, not with the trap door closed." "But Renee and the men would have to walk out past all the people in the cafeteria." Michael shook his head. "There's another way out of the basement. There's some steps that lead up to the parking lot out back.
I guess that's where the trucks brought in supplies. Those doors are locked from the outside with two padlocks, but I could make sure they were unlocked. Renee and Gil and the Maz would have to be back by 1 a.m. when their little book club wraps up for the day. Renee lets the guard out, says, "Sorry, we didn't know you were stuck in here. Couldn't hear you over all the noise from people above us." Whoever pulls meat locker duty will be some pissed, but I bet they won't even tell Ben Patchett. Too embarrassed. Also, who wants to wind up sucking a rock for 2 days when no one got hurt and everything turned out fine? Nick sat watching them both, his knees drawn up under his chin. He couldn't know what they were talking about, didn't read lips, but his face was as ill as if he were watching the two of them handle sticks of TNT. "Good, Michael. That's good," Harper said. "It's simple. With this kind of thing, the simpler the better, don't you think?" He ran his thumb along the tight twists of his beard.
"I think it's just great. As long as the prisoners don't decide to knock Renee down and run for it as soon as they're out of the basement."
"They wouldn't need to knock her down," Harper said. "If they decided to run, Renee would run with them. But I think she can convince them they have a better chance of long-term survival if they ally themselves with the firemen. They don't just want to escape. They want to last." She had not forgotten about the way Gil spoke of the firemen, with a mix of quiet admiration and something approaching reverence. "Yeah, well, maybe. But maybe when they get out of the basement, it would be best if Allie was waiting for them out in the parking lot with a rifle over her shoulder. She doesn't have to point it at them. It's enough just for her to have it on her. When Allie isn't confined to the girls' dorm, she's usually doing one punishment assignment or another. I could arrange it so she has to scrub pans that night. Ben Patchett works out the daily punishment details, but he lets me hand them out. So Allie collects all the pans from the kitchen and goes outside and finds the gun I've left for her. She's waiting by the basement doors when Renee comes out with the prisoners. She'd have to be back by 1 a.m., too. Anxiety tickled Harper's stomach. It seemed like there was a lot that could go wrong. "What about Don Lewiston?" Harper said. "He's easy. He spends most of the night down along the water, tending to his fishing poles. No one minds him. He's not under observation. He can meet you at the dock, row you across."
"And you?" Harper asked. "Will you come, Michael? I'd like it if you were there. I think Allie would, too."
He showed her a small, apologetic smile and gave his head a curt shake.
"Nope, better not.
I'll make sure I've been assigned guard duty here in the infirmary, so I can slip you out and cover for you while you're gone. I don't need to be a part of your conference anyway. Allie can fill me in later." He looked sidelong at Nick and said, "Take the kid, too. Bet he'd love to see his sister. And John."
Harper said, "I'm fighting the urge to hug you very, very hard, Michael Lindquist."
"Why fight it?" he asked.
7. But in the end, Nick didn't want to go. When the hour came, he was sitting in the worn-out chair beside Father Story's cot, reading a comic book. A man made of flame did battle with an enormous yellow and orange robot that resembled a walking freight liner, headlights for eyes and shovels for hands. He said he wanted to stay with Tom.
"What if he wakes up and we're gone?" Nick asked her in sign. "There ought to be someone here if he opens his eyes."
"Michael will be here," Harper said. Nick shook his head, his face solemn.
"That's not the same."
Then he added, "Grandfather's been moving a lot. He could wake up any time." It was true. Sometimes Tom Story took a deep breath and heaved a great, satisfied-sounding sigh, or he would produce a sudden humming noise, as if he had just had a quite surprising thought. Other times his right hand would drift up to rub his breastbone for a moment or two before falling back to his side. What Harper liked best was the way, sometimes, Tom would lift one finger to his lips in the shh gesture and smile. It was an expression that made Harper think of one child inviting another to share a hiding place during a game of hide-and-seek. Tom had been in his hiding place for months, but maybe was almost ready to reveal himself. Harper nodded, smoothed down Nick's hair, and left him to the company of his comic book and the silent old man. Michael was in the waiting room, and Don Lewiston was with him, had turned up to escort Harper down to the water.
Don wore a plaid winter coat and a cap with ear flaps, and his nose was pink from the cold. He stood in the half-open door. Michael was on his feet, too. Didn't seem able to sit down, but instead paced the waiting area.